Hello, warm good afternoon to everyone. It's our first time for my wife and I. Well, the first time from my wife might have been to Oakland before. I haven't. But amazing how many faces I recognize in the audience. From camp, from the feast. Hal's been avoiding me like the plague for years. I think he was in Bend the year that the Spanish language translator passed out and fell on the floor. But Hal, I've grown old since then. Now I wear these ridiculous glasses, so due to age, I don't speak as fast as I used to. But it's nice to be here. Mr. Orth is here. He helped us out a number of years in Bend at the feast with music. And I see Caleb Breidenthal and his father Don, who we went to college with, and some of the other young men, Febworth and others, that we've had the privilege of serving at camp. The Northwest Camp is headed for another beautiful year. For those who haven't been there, God really blessed us with a gorgeous location. We have about a half mile of private, brand-new, beautiful beach in Oregon. And the other side of the camp is a pretty much private lake. And we have beautiful facilities. The girls actually have a lounge and laundry facility. Well, not laundry. They've got a kitchen, though, kitchenette, private baths in their dorms, which beats the old huts with the wooden bunks and the squirrels running around them that we had at some other locations. But certainly encourage anyone who would like to apply for camp to be on staff for campers. It's an opportunity of a lifetime to be able to attend this just incredible facility that we have at Camp Magruder on the Oregon coast. And if I had time, I would tell you the story of how we were able to get that after a year and a half of searching, and God just really gave it to us. And the group that was using it, the Red Cross, had built their own facility, and then we just happened to call the camp at the right time, if you want to put it in those terms. But certainly nice to be here. I pray every day for Mr. Tuck, for his speedy and full recovery, and certainly speaking on behalf of the rest of the ministry in the Northwest, we are very anxious for God to restore him to complete health and service. When our numbers are getting older and dwindling, you know, we need every man we have. We certainly don't need to lose any. We certainly don't need any to be sick and incapacitated. But it happens from time to time, and we do pray for his help. And before I begin, I do have a special prayer request. This last Tuesday, we baptized a lady in my bathtub. Smallest person I've ever baptized. Little thing about 4 foot, 7 or 8. I'm sure she, soaping wet, may have been, what, 70, 80 pounds? Her name is Dolly Dean. She has been studying our material for years, certainly in recent months, very vigorously. She has been very enthusiastic about getting baptized, but she has COPD in a very severe way, and she wears oxygen, has to have a bottle on a cart to go anywhere. She's been hospitalized 3 times in the last month, and she was very intense, very aggressive about getting baptized, which I appreciate because so many people that we've talked to about that in the last years seem to be, you know, sort of less aggressive and maybe willing to wait months between counseling sessions. But certainly God was opening her mind. It was obvious. And she wants more than anything to be healthy enough to attend church at least a few times before she dies. I'm hoping God will give her a lot of strength and give her several years of growing and overcoming. She does listen on the Internet each week. She does listen to many sermon tapes. But appreciate your prayers for Dolly, that God would give her some more life. The doctors have told her that death is imminent. And in fact, after we baptized her, we got her home. She was on the nebulizer and full bore on the oxygen, which meant the tank only lasted about an hour and a half. And she did have a very difficult time that evening, but she so appreciated finally being able to be baptized. She could only leave the house for about 3 hours, and then she has to be back. So we couldn't baptize her after church. She has been to church once. We were hoping she could come. Then we would take her over to one of our church members' houses that's close, and they have a swimming pool that's heated, plus they have a bathtub we could have used, but we simply couldn't have gotten her to church and then there and then home in time without her running out of oxygen and then very likely dying, or having a very serious medical event. But certainly want to ask you to pray for Dolly. Her heart is golden, and we want to see her be able to grow and become a part of God's church if God decides in his mercy to grant her that much time. The story of the days of unleavened bread begin with a washed-up fugitive running from the law. Did you realize that? The story of the days of unleavened bread begin with a washed-up fugitive running from the law. I want to begin today over in Exodus chapter 2 and verse 11. The man named Moses, according to the account that we have in Josephus, combined with the biblical account, lived his first 40 years in Egypt. He had the Pharaoh's daughter as his stepmother. Of course, he was able to be nursed and raised in his younger years by his own mother. But when he became old enough, according to Josephus, he was a great orator, he was a great general, and he rose very quickly through the ranks in the Egyptian court. In Exodus chapter 2 and verse 11, it came to pass in those days when Moses was grown, he went out to his brethren and looked at their burdens. He saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his own. He looked this way and that way, and when he saw no one, he killed the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. And when he went out the second day, behold, two Hebrew men were fighting. And he said to them, to one who did the wrong, why are you striking your companion? He said, who has made you a prince and a judge over us? Do you intend to kill me as you killed the Egyptian? So Moses feared and said, surely this thing is known. When Pharaoh heard of this matter, he sought to kill Moses. But Moses fled from the face of Pharaoh and dwelt in the land of Midian, and he sat down by a well. Now in chapter 3, God introduces himself to this fugitive that we really have about a 40-year time period between the last few verses of chapter 2 and the beginning of chapter 3. In chapter 3 of Moses in verse 1, Moses, or chapter 3 of Exodus in verse 1, Moses was tending the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian. And he led the flock in the back of the desert, and he came to Horeb, the mountain of God. The angel of the Lord appeared to him in a fire from the midst of the bush. And so he looked, and behold, the bush was burning with fire, but nothing was consumed. So Moses, out there in the desert, after these probably 39, almost 40 years of being a shepherd, he sees this burning bush. Moses said, I'll turn now aside and see this great sight. Why is this bush glowing but not burning? So he turned aside, and God called to him and said, Moses, Moses, he said, here I am. So God begins to introduce himself to this fugitive from the law. He said, do not draw near this place. Take off your sandals off of your feet, for the place where you stand is holy ground. Moreover, he said, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look on God. So God introduces himself. He tells Moses who he is. Then he begins to make some very big promises. He said, I've surely heard, I've surely seen the oppression of my people who are in Egypt. I've heard their cry because of their taskmasters, for I know their sorrows. So I've come down to deliver them out of the Egyptians and to bring them up from that land to a land, a good and large land, a land flowing with milk and honey, to the place of the Canaanites and the Hittites and the Amorites and the Perizzites and the Hivites and the Jebusites. Now therefore, behold, the cry of the children of Israel has come up to me, as I have also seen the oppression which the Egyptians oppressed them. There are so many parallels between the events of the Exodus and the events of the end time. And while I don't want to be preoccupied with antitypes and types and forerunners, I think it's interesting to at least note here, where's the other place in the Bible where it says the cry has come up before God? It's in Revelation, where we have Revelation chapter 5, you have this picture of God's throne. And it says the cries of God's servants have come up before him. And he says, well, wait a little while till your fellow servants are killed just like you were. So even in the very beginning, we have some more parallels between what is going to happen, hopefully in the near future here, as the return of Jesus Christ draws closer, and these plagues and these events that happened in the land of Egypt many years ago. Verse 10, come now therefore, and I will send you to Pharaoh, that you may bring my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt. And he said, Moses said, okay, when do we leave? No, Moses said to God, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh? And he said, and what should I bring the children of Israel out of Egypt? How can I do this? Pharaoh wants to kill me. Verse 12 is interesting. He said, I will certainly be with you. God promises to be with Moses. In fact, God promises to be with everyone that he calls. In fact, this is the first promise God made to Abraham. Just hold your place there. Let's go to Genesis chapter 28 and verse 15. When God came to Abraham and appeared to him, he says, you do what I tell you and I will be with you. The same thing he told Moses. You do what I tell you, and I will be with you. Even though Moses didn't understand, certainly Abraham did not quite understand what God wanted him to do. Genesis 28 and verse 15, "Behold, I am with you, and will keep you wherever you go. I'll protect you. I will keep you wherever you go. I will bring you back to this land, for I will not leave you until I have done what I have spoken to you." And that's a sentence you ought to memorize. God will not leave you until He has fulfilled everything He has spoken to you. Let's go over to Hebrews chapter 13 and verse 5, because here is a promise He's spoken to us. We don't even have to turn to Matthew 28 and verse 20, where He says, "I'll be with you to the end of the earth. All power in heaven and earth is given unto me. And you will go to all the earth and preach the gospel to every creature, baptizing them in the name of the Father, Son, through God's Holy Spirit, and teach them to observe all things I've commanded you. And lo, I will be with you to the very end." The same thing He told Abraham. The same thing He told Moses. And in Hebrews chapter 13 and verse 5, the most important lesson in life, perhaps, we can learn when God calls us. He says, "Let your conduct be without covetousness. Be content with such things as you have, for He Himself has said, I will never leave you or forsake you." The first promise to Abraham, the first promise to Moses, and the first promise to you. The title for my sermon today is Fear or Faith, the historical lesson of the days of unleavened bread. Fear or faith is your choice every day. You can have faith that this first promise to Abraham, to Moses, and to you, that God says, "I will never leave you or forsake you. I will be with you until I have performed every word I promised unto you." We have a choice to have faith and believe that, or to have fear and not believe it, and perhaps go back on our commitment and our promise. Exodus chapter 3, let's return to verse 18. When Moses here begins to say, "Wait a minute, God, I don't want to go. You don't want to send me." In fact, a number of times, five altogether, Moses tells God, "I can't do this. Who am I going to say they sent me?" "Well, say that I am that I am. I am that I exist. The Eternal has sent you." Verse 18, God says, "They will then heed your voice, and you shall come, you and the soldier or the elders of Israel, to the king of Egypt, and you shall say to him, 'The Lord God of the Hebrews has met with us. Now please let us go 3 days' journey into the wilderness, that we may sacrifice to the Lord.' But I am sure that the king of Egypt will not let you go except by a very mighty hand." So he promises, "I will stretch out my hand and strike Egypt with all my wonders, which I will do in its midst. After that, he will let you go." So God not only tells Moses, "I'll be with you, never leave you, never forsake you," He also tells him prophetically, pretty specifically, what is going to happen as all of these events unfold. Now, in Moses' eye, I'm thinking, well, this is going to happen pretty quickly. I'm going to go talk to Israelites. They're going to go, "Rah, rah, rah, Moses, let's get out of Egypt. I'm going to go talk to Pharaoh. He's going to say, 'I'm scared to death, leave,' and it's all going to be over." But had that happened, Moses would not have learned some very important lessons of faith. Certainly the Israelites would not have learned some lessons of faith. And so God sometimes tells us He'll be with us. He tells us what's going to happen, and then events don't proceed just as fast as we would like. Or the road might be a little bumpier than we would like. Or it might take a lot longer than we would like. So let's continue over in chapter 4 and verse 1. We have here two more expressions of a lack of faith on the part of Moses. Moses answered and said, "Well, suppose they won't believe me or listen to my voice. What if they say the Lord has not appeared to you?" So the Lord said, "Well, what is that in your hand?" He said, "A rod." He said, "Cast it to the ground." He cast it on the ground, and it became a serpent. And Moses fled from it. The Lord said to Moses, "Well, reach out your hand and take it by the tail." So he reached out his hand and took it by the tail. So God gives him here baby step faith to take. Baby steps. Reaching out and grabbing that snake by the tail wasn't quite as requiring of courage as marching into Pharaoh's royal throne room and demanding, "Let my people go." But we all learn to obey God by incremental steps of faith. And we learn that he said he will never leave us or forsake us because he put it to small tests first. And then we realize God really does mean that. He really will keep his word until the day that he has fulfilled every promise he has given. So let's drop down now to verse 4. The Lord said to Moses, "Reach your hand and take it by the tail." He did. Then down in verse 5, "Furthermore, the Lord said to him, put your hand in your bosom." And he put his hand in his bosom, or just inside his robe, and his hand came out leprous. And God said, "Put it back in again." And, of course, it came out restored and clean like the other flesh. God said, "Okay, if it will be they will not believe the first sign, they will believe the second. Because at the mouth of two witnesses, the thing should be established." But he knew that Moses was weak in faith. He had a lot of growing to do, a lot of learning. "It shall be if they don't believe even these two signs, if Pharaoh and the Israelites don't believe these signs, give them a third. If they don't listen to your voice, take water from the river and pour it on dry land, and the water which you take from the river will become blood on the dry land." Now you would think now that after these excuses are gone and all of these miracles God has just shown Moses, Moses is ready to take up and go to Egypt. No, Moses said to the Lord, "Lord, I am not eloquent, neither before nor since you have spoken to your servant." This is the first time we've ever talked. "But I am slow of speech and slow of tongue," which is different than the account that Josephus gives of him. But perhaps since it had been 40 years since he had done any public speaking, except perhaps to sheep. And sheep, by the way, don't mind what you say to them. I've raised a few. Dogs do. Dogs kind of, you know, reel in fear if you yell at them, which you shouldn't do. But at any rate, the sheep probably didn't care. It wasn't like being in Spokesman's Club, being out on the mountain with all the sheep. So the Lord said to him, "Who has made man's mouth, or who makes the mute, the deaf, the seeing, or the blind? Haven't I made them? Therefore go, I'll be with your mouth and teach you what you shall say." Now, it's one of those promises. God, why did you say that to me about 30 or 40 years ago? Because with my mouth I've done a whole bunch of dumb things I shouldn't have done. Said some things I wish I shouldn't have said. I can't reach out there and grab them. So God told Moses, go in to speak with Pharaoh, and basically I'll do the speaking for you. Just open your mouth and my words will come out. Well, Moses didn't even believe that. Moses said in verse 13, "Oh my Lord, please send by the hand of somebody else." This is getting to be pretty serious. God's starting to get a little bit angry for him. But there are certain excuses that reveal here his lack of faith. First time God had talked to him. God was calling him for a special purpose. But Moses was to learn that God does not go back on his calling. When God has a job, has a purpose, and he calls someone out of the world, or out of, in his case, the pasture or the mountainside full of sheep, there is a reason for it, and God does not change his mind. Let's go back to Romans chapter 11 and verse 29. Very important verse for all of us. Because we've been called by God to come out of the world. We've been called by God to give our lives to him, to live for a higher purpose than just self, live for a higher purpose than just fame, fortune, money, or even as the world calls them, the pride of life, the lust of the flesh. All of those things are passing away. Could be passing away a lot sooner than what many of us realize. A number of years ago, my wife and I went over to Africa on a trip, visit my daughter Holly, who was working in a hospital, if you want to call it that, in Gaborone, Botswana. And as part of the trip, we went up to Zimbabwe, which had been, of course, Rhodesia many years ago under British administration. And when it was turned over to the new administration, Mr. Mugabe, then the American dollar and the Rhodesian dollar were on a par, 1-to-1. By the time we were there in 2006, it was about 500,000-to-1. And so we went out to dinner in a fairly nice restaurant, one of the better restaurants there, I suppose, and a steak dinner cost us $2.6 million. And, you know, it felt good to have a big stack of $1,000 bills and $10,000 bills 4 inches high, and to have that feeling of being a millionaire once in my life, you know, paying $2.6 million for dinner. For this little steak dinner, it was really about $13, $14 American. But while we were over there, we talked to some of the natives. We stayed in one of the hostels. And someone said, I forget who it was, but it was somebody that was there, said, I want you to understand, because I talked to you about how worthless their money is. He said, please understand that when the currency is worth nothing, everybody is poverty stricken. He said the wealthy people that had houses and had cars and had things, they couldn't even sell them. What little they had, they could barter. But he said, you Americans need to understand that when the currency is devalued to nothing, everybody in that country is poverty stricken. Virtually nobody has any wealth. It won't matter who was rich and who was poor, because when the money's worth nothing, you're all basically worth nothing. And of course, they were in the depths of destitution. And you know what my wife did? She stole my tennis shoes. I was sleeping, taking my afternoon nap, which I enjoy doing on vacation, in this hostel in Victoria, Zimbabwe. We had toured the waterfall there at Victoria Falls, beautiful place. So my wife pops into the room. She'd been down to the market, and she steals my tennis shoes, which were, by the way, old tennis shoes I had planned on throwing away. But she traded them in the market for a beautiful chess set that we gave to my son. And then she also bought three almost life-size giraffes made out of wood and a 38-pound water, kind of a little pig, you know, more like a little hippo statue, which I ended up carrying around on my back in a backpack in this big casket-sized package of giraffes for the next 3 days, wearing my socks because my shoes were stolen and gone. Now, they were aqua socks. They had a little bit of rubber bottom to them, but the roads over there are not paved. They're pretty much just gravel and sharp rock. And so I've forgiven her, but all I can say, man, is if you go to Africa, keep your shoes close. Don't let your wife get near them. But the important thing is that our economy is headed the same direction. Our money's becoming worthless. I don't know how many of you are students of the Weimar Republic of the 1920s in Germany, but they borrowed one-third of their national budget for 5 years before their currency collapsed. How many years have we borrowed one-third of our national budget? Anyone know? Can you count to three? Now, if they did it for five and their currency collapsed, how many years do we have left to go? Anybody here not go to American schools recently and can add and subtract? Two. We've got 2 years left borrowing the amount of money we are currently borrowing if we're going to collapse like the Weimar Republic did. I'm not saying we're going to, but that's what happened historically. And, of course, eventually that turned into a dictatorship from a man named Adolf Hitler. So we do not live in easy times. We are facing some very serious challenges in the near future. In Romans chapter 11, verse 29, God says, the gifts and the calling of God are irrevocable. So when God said, Moses, I want you to go to Egypt. Moses said, I don't want to go to Egypt. I can't talk. I'm afraid of Pharaoh. I don't want to go. God said, that's okay. I'll call somebody else. No, God didn't say that. Now, God called you at some point in your life, and you had the choice between saying, yes, God, I want to be in your kingdom, or God, I'm really just too busy right now. I'm not interested in you and your kingdom. But the fact that you were here says you accepted the calling. The God who called you said, I will never leave you or forsake you. I'll be with you until I accomplish every promise, every word I have given, and the gifts and calling of God, in other words, the calling of God, but also his assistance, his help, the gifts he promises so that you can live a life of faith and not fear, those are irrevocable. Circumstances don't change the fact that God will never change his mind about calling you. Some translations have, the gifts and calling of God are not repented of. He never changes. He's never sorry he called you, even though many of us obviously have been weak. We've had moments where we've sinned we shouldn't have, but thankfully he's very, very forgiving and very merciful, and he's able to bring us back to the fold. Let's go back to Exodus chapter 5. We have here Moses going through a test of patience with not much faith. God begins to get the attention of the Israelites. And it's stunning. God told Moses, you go to the Israelites and tell them you're going to lead them out, and you're going to lead them out. And so he did that, and the Israelites said, Moses, get lost. We don't want to hear what you have to say. And Moses did not understand why God said, this is what's going to happen. He went to Egypt. It didn't happen like he thought it was supposed to happen. It happens so often in our life that we think God is going to work out something a certain way, and it works out some other way, and we kind of wonder what happened. I can't figure that out. Sometimes when it's all over, then we can figure it out. Sometimes months, years later, we say, aha, that's why that happened that way. Exodus chapter 5. Moses and Aaron went in and told Pharaoh, "Thus says the Lord God of Israel, let my people go, that they may hold a fast to me in the wilderness." Verse 2, Pharaoh said, "Who is this Lord that I should obey his voice and let Israel go? I don't know him, and I'm not going to let Israel go." So they said, "Well, the God of the Hebrews has met with us. Please let us go 3 days." Notice the word please. Their lack of faith here causes a lack of courage. You know, there is courage in righteousness. It's called the power of righteousness, the power of faith. Paul told Timothy about it. There's a certain power in knowing what you're doing is in accordance with God's will and is right, and you can stand up against teachings of people like Pharaoh. But at this point, Moses and Aaron are still a little bit weak. They're choosing a little bit of combination of faith and fear. Verse 4, the king of Egypt said to Moses and Aaron, "Why do you take the people from their work? Get back to your work. You're just trying to get out of your work." Pharaoh said, "Look, the people of the land are many, and now you make them rest from their labor." There's some indication that Moses also told them they were going to start keeping the Sabbath. That's not in here. We have to kind of look at other historical sources and by implication, not necessary direct statements. Pharaoh said, "Look, the people of the land are many. You're trying to get them to rest." The same day, Pharaoh commanded the taskmasters of the people and their officers, saying, "Don't give them any more straw, but don't let them reduce their number of bricks." So the people were scattered throughout the land, down in verse 12. And, of course, the officers were very evil to them. Now, what began to happen here, of course, is that the people of Israel began to resent the Egyptians. Down in verse 20, as they came out from Pharaoh, they met Moses and Aaron, who stood with them. And they said, "Let the Lord look on you and judge, because you have made us abhorrent in the sight of Pharaoh, in the sight of his servants, and put a sword in their hands." Now what's going on here tells us what's going to happen later. Too many of the Israelites were comfortable living in Egypt. Even months later they said, "Oh, remember the garlic and the leeks we had in Egypt." I don't know how many people like leeks, but they lusted after them. They had little houses. They had to work hard, apparently 7 days a week. But for some reason, many of them had become comfortable living in Egypt. So God allowed a turn of events here to let them recognize just how evil Pharaoh was and to see just how oppressed they were. Pharaoh was a type of the beast, the man of sin, or the beast power that rises in Revelation chapter 13. Indeed, there will be many people who will be comfortable with that society and with those teachings. And they learn to accommodate and learn perhaps to say, I can live here. It isn't all that bad. I don't really need to leave. And so there will be a chain of events called the Great Tribulation and the enforcing of the mark of the beast, which will cause those who feel that way to understand how evil the new beast system that's coming will be. Just like the Israelites here had to understand just how evil Pharaoh and the Egyptian system were on them. Chapter 6, verse 1 says, "The Lord said to Moses, 'Now you shall see what I'll do to Pharaoh. With a strong hand he will let you go. With a strong hand he will drive them out of this land.'" Moses probably thought, good, tomorrow it'll all be finished. Only it wasn't finished tomorrow. It drug on for almost another month, and it drug on for a long time before Moses finally was able to have Pharaoh listen to his words and say, "Yes, please leave." God spoke to Moses and said, "I am the Lord. I appeared to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob." He kind of had to give him some reinforcement here. He says, verse 4, "I have established my covenant with them to give them the land of Canaan, the land of their pilgrimage in which they were strangers. And I have heard the groaning of the children of Israel, whom the Egyptians keep in bondage, and I've remembered my covenant." So God says, "I am going to bring them out. I'm going to bring them out." Moses is probably getting to think, "Well, you know, we didn't do it last time we went to Pharaoh. Maybe this time will be it." And of course, it took a lot more time and took a lot more going in and out to Pharaoh, a lot more plagues before it happened. Let's start down in verse 7. "I'll take you out as my people. I'll be your God. Then you shall know that I'm the Lord your God who brings you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians." And of course, it took a long time before they would learn. Now let's start down to chapter 7 and verse 1. "The Lord said to Moses, 'I have made you as a God to Pharaoh, and Aaron your brother shall be your prophet.' So Moses is telling, or God is telling Moses, to get some confidence, to get rid of the fear, and start acting more in faith. Moses is, you know, learning and growing, just like each one of us begins to learn and to grow. As we put God to the test, and we learn in baby steps to make the decision of faith, not the decision of fear. Verse 2, you shall speak all that I command you, and Aaron your brother shall tell Pharaoh to send the children of Israel out of his land. But I will harden Pharaoh's heart and multiply my signs and my wonders in the land of Egypt. But Pharaoh will not heed you, so that I may bring my hand on Egypt and bring my armies and my people, the children of Israel, out of the land of Egypt by great judgments. So God tells Moses now, Pharaoh's going to harden his heart. He's not going to let you go until there are some great miracles and some great judgments. And he did the rod thing again. Moses and Aaron both had the rods that fell down. Let's drop down to chapter 7, a little bit farther down. Verse 7, Moses was 80 years old and Aaron was 83 years old when they spoke to Pharaoh. You know, Moses here is beginning to understand that God keeps his word. It might not work out exactly as Moses pictured it when God first said it, but he's beginning to understand because he's appeared before Pharaoh now several times and he's still alive. The death sentence that was passed upon him has not been carried out, and Pharaoh is at least beginning to learn. But faith has to be based on something. Faith is based on promises, on truth, on support, because God keeps his word. Moses was growing in faith. It doesn't mean that he just had this feeling that people call faith. You know, he had a feeling that God would free Israel from slavery. He based his faith on evidence, on seeing God's promises fulfilled, on seeing God work in the lives of not only him and Aaron, but the people of Israel beginning to change their attitude, and also, of course, finally, Pharaoh himself. Now, over in chapter 8, we have kind of a watershed change in the attitude of Moses. Moses here is beginning to reflect on what God has told him. He's beginning to think, you know what, God keeps his word. Maybe I can have a little more faith than I have showed before. So Exodus chapter 8, verse 8. Pharaoh called for Moses and Aaron and said, entreat the Lord that he may take away the frogs for me and for my people. And I will let the people go that they may sacrifice to the Lord. Moses said to Pharaoh, accept the honor of saying when I shall intercede for you, for your servants, and for your people, to destroy the frogs from you and your houses, that they may remain in the river only. And he said, tomorrow. He said, let it be according to your word, that you may know there is no one like the Lord our God. Now this is said to a worshiper of the Nile River. The king was also, in a sense, a high priest of the worship of the river that overflowed its banks and gave Egypt its bounty of food every year. And they worshipped animals in the river, the crocodiles, and of course they worshipped what they call the sun god Ra, this, you know, that they pictured as coming in a boat, a Nile River boat going across the sky every day. And so when he said, there's no other God but our God, it was a real step of courage. So Moses did that. He cried out to God, and God withdrew the frogs that were plaguing Egypt. Then down in verse 25, Moses finally is to the place where he is telling Pharaoh how things are going to be. Instead of being afraid, timid, saying please, please and thank you, he instead is telling Pharaoh, this is the way things are going to be, because the God that is serving, that I am serving, is much greater than the God you are serving. So Pharaoh called for Moses and Aaron and said, verse 25, go sacrifice to your God in the land. Moses said, it's not right to do so, for we would be sacrificing the abomination of the Egyptians to the Lord our God. Now what is happening here is what's called negotiations. Now Satan knows that he can get you to compromise, that before long you'll kind of be comfortable with compromising. So Satan's goal for anyone who's a committed Christian is to get you to compromise just one time, because second time is easier, third time is easier than that. And before long, we have what the Bible calls a seared conscience. So Pharaoh, here, picturing Satan, knew that if he could negotiate and get Moses to just, you know, give in on one point, that eventually he'd win the battle. That's why Satan wants you to begin compromising, not keeping his laws quite like you should, in just one point. Because once that foot is in the door, he can force that door open with more and more temptations and more human reasoning. So Moses said, look, don't go to the desert. Just sacrifice there in Goshen and be happy, Moses. You guys shouldn't have to work, you know, 3 days out, 3 days back. That's 6 days of unnecessary walking and travel. So just sacrifice to God there in Goshen. Moses said, I can't do that because we would be sacrificing the abomination of the Egyptians to the Lord our God. All the Egyptians watching us sacrificing sheep would be very upset and angry. It says, if we sacrifice the abomination of the Egyptians before their eyes, won't they stone us? No, he said, we're going to go 3 days' journey into the wilderness and sacrifice to the Lord our God as he has commanded. So Moses is telling Pharaoh this is the way things are going to be. Pharaoh's trying to get him to compromise. Pharaoh said, well, I'll let you go that you may sacrifice to the Lord your God in the wilderness. Only don't go so far away. You know, look, half a day, just get across the horizon, 6 or 7 miles, whatever, so that the Egyptians don't see you and stone you, but let's not go this three-day thing. So, you know, Satan never quits trying to get you to compromise. He's the ultimate negotiator. He has an arsenal of temptations that never ends. And not only that, but he has 6,000 years of dealing with people who are just like you. You know, just every few years he gets a new shipment of people to give temptation to, whereas for us it's a new experience. So Moses said, no, we're not going to do that. Verse 29, Moses said, indeed I am going out from you, and I will entreat the Lord that the swarms of the flies may depart tomorrow from Pharaoh, from his servants and from his people, but let Pharaoh not deal deceitfully anymore. He said, I'm not going to compromise with you anymore. We're not going to negotiate. Forget what you think you're trying to do here. But Pharaoh was a professional negotiator trying to get them to compromise, even as Satan today does with us. Now over in chapter 11, we find that the people of Israel have finally gotten the message. They first laughed at Moses. When the Egyptians made them go and work and get their own straw, they actually threw things at him and yelled at him, tried to chase him out of the land, said, you're not going to take us out of here. But because they were now becoming very resentful and they woke up to see just how evil Egypt was, they said, okay, and they listened to Moses. They'd seen some of the plagues. They'd seen what God was doing with Moses. And so they then said, okay, we are going to listen. Chapter 11, verse 1. The Lord said to Moses, I will bring one more plague on Pharaoh and on Egypt. Afterwards, he will let you go. He will surely drive you out of here altogether. Verse 3. The Lord gave the people favor in the sight of the Egyptians. Moreover, the man of Moses was very great in the land of Egypt, in the sight of Pharaoh's servants, and the sight of all his people. So God kept his promise here, but it didn't happen the first time Moses went to Pharaoh. And it took a number of days for Moses to grow in faith and finally the people of Israel to grow in faith and to begin to believe that Moses truly had been sent from God. And so during this time, as they were beginning to keep the first days of unleavened bread, they were beginning to learn the lesson of choosing faith and not fear. Now over in chapter 14 and verse 1, they're getting ready to go. This is after the Passover. And the first night when they left Egypt with the pillar of cloud leading them by day and the pillar of fire by night. It actually didn't change nature, just the way it appeared, but that's another descriptive story that's given to us in Ezekiel chapter 1 and chapter 10. So the Lord spoke to Moses. This is important. There were three places where the Israelites camped as they left Egypt during that week of unleavened bread. They're leaving here on the first day of unleavened bread. God says, speak to the children of Israel that they turn and camp before Pihahiroth, between Migdol and the sea, beside Baal Zephon. Now Moses knew these areas. That's not far from where he'd been herding sheep. He says, you shall camp before it by the sea. Now essentially it's a row of mountains or hills that go right down into the shore of the Dead Sea. The word Pihahiroth means the mouth of gorges. It means this mouth where these gorges are on all sides. Migdol was a place where there was a well 250 feet deep there, but the water was bitter, so it was called the well or the place of bitterness. Baal Zephon meant the master of gloom. It was a place of worship of the god, the Egyptian god Typhon. He was a demon god of Egypt, one of these ones that has the fire coming through his eyes, a big old, you know, kind of a carved rock demonic type idol. So God says, I've got a great place for a vacation camp. It's in this mouth of gorges at a place called Bitterness, and it's right by the master of gloom. I mean, this doesn't make a whole lot of sense to be encouraging, right? But they're still on there. Now, when they're camping here, by the way, the first place they camped was at the border. So the first place they camp here is at the border. They're on the next morning, they're leaving Egypt. The next morning, they're completely walking out. So they are camping. They had actually left Goshen and walked out the first holy day. And as they came to a stop, they were on the border. That was the border line that was administered and owned by the Egyptians. And the next morning, they were going to be heading out, leaving the land completely. And God says, I want you to camp in this horrible place where there's no place for you to go. You are going to be completely hemmed in. Now, why was that? Verse 4. I will harden Pharaoh's heart so he'll pursue them. And I will gain honor over Pharaoh and over all his army, that the Egyptians may know that I am the Lord. And they did so. Now, God sometimes, apparently, if we use this as an example, allows things to happen or even organizes things to happen in our life so that we can grow and choose faith, not fear, but also as an example or as a lesson, perhaps to others, our family, our fellow members in the church, who knows what it is. In this case, the people of Israel are not taking the easy way to the promised land because God wants to teach a lesson to Pharaoh. He could have said, well, God, figure out some other way to teach Pharaoh. Why do we have to suffer while you're doing that? Well, I don't know. I wish we had the answer. But there are times when God directs us into difficulty just for the glory of getting us out. People have to learn. If it wasn't that way, we might not learn. There are times that God allows us, because of our own foolishness and actions, to get into some very difficult positions. Any volunteers, if we were Pentecost, we could all give testimonials. I did this stupid, and this is what happened, and I cried to God for a week and a half, and finally there was a light at the end of the tunnel, and we're still here today. So sometimes we do our own foolish things. We're human. We have human foibles. And God allows us then to see His glory in getting us out. There are also times when God Himself orchestrates the difficulty just for the glory of getting us out and for the lessons we might learn. Now, hold the place there, but over in Revelation 12 and verse 13, another of the many parallels of the children leaving Egypt, children of Israel, and what's going to happen in the time of the end. In Revelation 12, we have the prophecy about the church, kind of an historical allegory to begin with, but in verse 13, it says, when the dragon, which is, of course, typified by Pharaoh, saw that he had been cast to the earth, he persecuted the woman who gave birth to the male child. To the woman was given two wings of a great eagle. Later, God told Moses, I brought them out of the wilderness on the wings of a great eagle, that she might fly into the wilderness to her place where she's nourished for a time and half a times from the presence of the serpent. So the church at the very end is going to be escaping the presence of the serpent. So the serpent spewed out water of his mouth like a flood after the woman, that he might cause her to be carried away by the flood. So this flood, picturing an army, is going to happen another time, a second time. But the earth helped the woman, and the earth opened its mouth and swallowed up the flood which the dragon had spewed out of his mouth. So the same type of thing happening again. We don't know, of course, exactly how it's going to happen. All we know is what the Bible says in Revelation 12. But when the waters of the Red Sea came together and destroyed Pharaoh and his army, it was a type of an event that's going to happen in the future. So something that's another lesson, one of many, many of these days of unleavened bread and, of course, these plagues and the story of the Israelites coming out of Egypt. Now back to Exodus 14. When the Israelites were hemmed in at the mouth of gorges by this place of bitterness and gloom, the master of gloom, their reaction was fear. They did not choose faith. They didn't stand up and say, we've seen all these plagues in Egypt. We know our God is greater than Pharaoh. We really don't care about his army because we have God on our side. Now, what did they say? They were terrified. They said to Moses, verse 11, because there were no graves in Egypt, you brought us out here in this wilderness to die. Have you so dealt with us to bring us up out of Egypt? Is this not the word that we told you when we were in Egypt, saying, let us alone, that we may serve the Egyptians? They were, some of them, comfortable being there. For it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than that we should die in this wilderness. So the people reacted with fear. They chose fear But Moses chose faith. Moses said to the people, "Don't be afraid. Stand still and see the salvation of the Lord." There will come a time in your life when there will be no answer except to stand still and see the salvation of the Lord. It might be cancer. It might be a dread disease. It might be a circumstance that you never thought would happen to you and your family. But there's even been circumstances in the church where we have to go to God on our knees and say, "I can't change anything." We have to stand still and watch God do it. So they were learning that God said He would never leave them or forsake them, but they were afraid. Moses finally had grown in faith enough to where his reaction here was not one of fear. His reaction was one of faith. But it took him a while to grow to that point, just like it will take you a while to grow to that point, and it will take each one of us a journey of watching God keep His Word to where we will know and know that we will know that He will always keep His Word. He says, "The Egyptians whom you see today, you're not going to see them again forever. This is it. The Lord will fight for you, and you shall hold your peace." So it still happens today. People get afraid. They choose fear over faith. I wonder how many might have lost out on the first resurrection just in the last 2,000 years because they chose fear. And fear became the decision maker in their lives. Let's go over to 1 John chapter 4 and verse 4. You know, this is a verse we don't read all that often in church. I was reading in this last week, and I thought, you know, why haven't I mentioned this verse more often in all the years that I've been standing behind these wooden podiums and microphones? Well, maybe it's something I need to change. But in 1 John chapter 4, we read this chapter often about love, that God is love. It's mentioned twice here, verse 8, verse 16. But what about verse 4? "You are of God, little children, and have overcome them." Why? "Because He who is in you is greater than he who is in the world." Moses had to learn that. The God who said, "I will never leave you or forsake you, I'll be with you always," is greater than the God of this world. But yet we fear the God of this world sometimes. We fear the circumstances that we see in this world controlled by Satan the devil. This ought to be a memory scripture. He who is in you is greater than he who is in the world. And therefore, every challenge you face, every trial that we find in this physical life, we have someone on our side who is greater than the cause of that trial or those who might want that trial to do us harm. And then down in verse 18, he says, "There is no fear in love." If we truly love God and understand in faith the promises He's made to us, there's no fear. But perfect love casts out fear, because fear involves torment. Now, isn't that interesting? Fear is torment. Being afraid is like being tortured. Being afraid is being unsure. Being afraid is not being able to sleep. Being afraid is being worried. Being afraid is a whole lot of bad things. Fear is torment. Faith is comfort. Faith is assurance. Not in ourselves, but in the God who promised us, just like He did Abraham and Moses, that He would not leave us ever or forsake us. In everyone's life, there are opportunities to choose fear or to choose faith. Now, one of my favorites, probably one of yours too, is in Mark chapter 4. In Mark chapter 4, Christ was preaching to the multitudes. There got to be so many people, and they were getting worn out and tired, so He told the disciples, "Let's go down and get in a boat." So in Mark chapter 4 and verse 33, we find Jesus Christ coming down and saying, "Well, let's go get in this boat." In verse 33, concluding the story here about His parables He was giving, "With many such parables He spoke the word to them as they were able to hear it. But without a parable He didn't speak to them, and when they were alone He explained all things to His disciples." So the multitude was not called, they were not given understanding. But the disciples were called. And that calling was never to be repented of or changed. And He explained to them, "This is what I was really trying to say." On the same day, when evening had come, He said to them, "Let us cross over to the other side." I want to ask you a question. When the being who has all power on heaven and earth says, let's cross over to the other side. Where are we going? Are we staying here? Are we going south, north? No, we're crossing over to the other side. Just like when the being with all power in heaven and earth says the gospel shall be preached in all the world for a witness. What's going to happen? Starbucks is going to open more coffee stores or what? How many think Jesus Christ didn't know there was a storm out there? How many think he was really surprised when they woke him up? He said, wow, I thought it was going to be calm today. Didn't you see the weatherman on Channel 7? No, that's not what he said. He said, we're going over to the other side. Now, when they left, they had a multitude. They took with him along the boat that he was in, or their little boats, and a great windstorm arose. Very likely, Satan the devil caused it. Satan is the prince in the power of the air. He's tried to stop what God is doing every step of the way since the day of creation. He tried to kill the babies in Israel. He tried to have Herod kill the babies during Christ's time. He had tried to have all of the Jews, the ancestors of Christ, killed during the time of Esther. And the number of times that we have in scriptures of Satan trying to stop God's plan are endless. One more, he was trying to capsize the boat, perhaps drown some of the disciples at least. So this great windstorm came up. Now these fishermen, by the way, at least 8 of the 12 disciples apparently were fishermen. They were very familiar with this lake. They knew storms came up. They were good seamen. So this must have been a very vicious storm. It must have been one of the worst ones ever on the Sea of Galilee. A great windstorm arose. The waves beat into the boat, so it was already filling. Christ was in the stern, asleep on a pillow. And they awoke him and said, Teacher, what do you care that we are perishing? So don't you care? We're all going to die. We are all going to drown. And of course, he arose, rebuked the wind, said, Peace be still. The wind ceased, and there was great calm. And he said to them, Why are you so fearful? How is it you have chosen fear and not faith? They should have had faith. They had just seen him feed 5,000 people with a couple loaves of bread and fish. But their faith was not yet grown to the place where they really understood that he would never leave them or forsake them. They began to see the circumstances around them instead of the words and the promises that he'd given to them. And so Christ knew there would be a storm, but these men felt he was asleep and they were alone. But let me tell you something. Feeling alone doesn't mean you're alone. Anybody ever feel alone and then all of a sudden realize I'm not alone? Sure, we've all felt that way. Just because you feel alone doesn't mean God has left. Doesn't mean that his calling for you has changed. It doesn't mean anything except that you have a feeling that you are alone, when in reality you are not alone. Because Jesus Christ said he would never leave us or forsake us. And there certainly are times when emotionally we do feel alone. We wonder how could this possibly work out. But having faith casts out fear. We cast out fear by having faith in what we don't see and looking past what we do see. Let's go over to Hebrews chapter 11. Did you know in the book of Hebrews, chapter 11 is the faith chapter? There are more verses in this faith chapter about Moses than about any other person. He is the rock star of Hebrews 11. Now, the rock star means he stood on the rock, Mount Sinai, but I'm not talking about, you know, Bon Jovi or some rock star. So he was the rock star of Mount Sinai, put it that way. And he has far more verses and words committed to him as a pillar of faith in this chapter about pillars of faith than anybody else. But we've just seen that when God first called him, he was a coward. When God first appeared to him, 5 times he said, no, choose somebody else. I don't want to do this. But God said, no, you are going to do it, and this is what's going to happen. And by the way, I'll be with you. You have no need to fear. Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 23. By faith, Moses, when he was born, was hidden 3 months by his parents. And that was their faith, not his. He says, they knew that he was a beautiful child, and they were not afraid of the king's command. So his parents showed a great example by not being afraid of Pharaoh. By faith, Moses, when he became of age, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter. So his mother told him who he was. He knew he was an Israelite, not an Egyptian by birth. And so he chose not to be adopted by Pharaoh or Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to suffer the affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin. That's a choice we all have to make. The world is so full of the lust of the eyes, the lust of the flesh, the pride of life, the celebrity culture we live in, where people are they're treated like they're superhuman because they can stand in front of a camera and pretend to be somebody else. You know, they're actors, or they can sing, or whatever it might be. We live in a crazy society that worships people, worships the environment, instead of the Creator and the God who gave us everything we have. So we all have the choice of choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin. It says, He esteemed the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures in Egypt, for He looked to the reward. Now that happened later, I believe, in His life. By faith He forsook Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king, for He endured as seeing Him who is invisible. I think that's when He was marching back to Egypt after God told Him, the king, the Pharaoh, cannot harm you because I'm with you. And the people of Israel are going to be brought out. Moses didn't know to begin with that things might not work out quite like he thought and that time might take many more days than he had planned. But nevertheless, God's word was true. And every single word that God promised happened, just like it will in our time. By faith He kept the Passover and the sprinkling of blood, lest he who destroyed the firstborn should touch them. By faith they passed through the Red Sea as by dry land, whereas the Egyptians attempting to do so were drowned. So Moses led them out, but he was not called as a man of faith. He was called as a man of fear. Now notice, he left Egypt the first time in fear, the second time in faith. It's interesting. He left Egypt twice. The first time as a fugitive running in fear. The second time he left as a conqueror going in faith. But growing in faith in that interim time was a process. There are several lessons we learned from Moses' life, that there's a process of learning that God means what He says. Just because God says it and we read it or hear it doesn't mean we believe it yet. It takes time for us to really believe that God means what He says. Also, that He will never leave us, but after He calls us, He will always be there. Also, delay, as we see it, means nothing. We are warned not to say in your heart, my Lord delays His coming, and begin to beat the servants and become drunken with the cares of this world. So delay, as we see it, means nothing. What God says will happen, and it will happen in His due time. And finally, number four, the first, by the way, were 1, 2, and 3. I forgot to mention that. I'm not one who often uses points or numbers. God may direct circumstances so that we grow in character and that we learn to choose faith over fear. But like Abraham, we're going to have to demonstrate to him that he is first in our life. So those circumstances that are brought to bear in our life, sometimes we don't understand, but we have to learn that it is in his will and part of his plan that we, like Moses, are to be growing in faith for a job that will last for all eternity. And finally, I want to go to what I think is the greatest promise in the New Testament. Let's go to John chapter 6. John chapter 6 and verse 39. If you think about the old Protestant song, Standing on the Promises, and you can get these Bible promise books that list all the promises in the Bible, and some say there are thousands, others say there are only a couple hundred or several hundred. I think the greatest promise in the entire New Testament is John chapter 6. Let's begin in verse 39. This is the will of the Father who sent me, that of all He has sent me, I should lose nothing, but raise it up the last day. It is Jesus Christ's will, and He gives us His word, that you make it, that you will not be lost. He said, every single one I call is my will, that they make it to the resurrection. Downright promise for your life. This is about as flat, straightforward as it can be. Christ said, I'm going to call you, give you the help, and it is my will that you be in the first resurrection. It doesn't really matter what happens between now and then in many other ways, because all of those chances will be chances to choose faith and not fear, and learn to put me above all, and understand that I mean what I say, that I will never leave you or forsake you. Or as Abraham was told, I'll be with you wherever you go. Verse 40 says, "And this is the will of Him who sent Me." In other words, God the Father. "That everyone who sees the Son and believes in Him may have everlasting life, and I will raise him up the last day." So Jesus Christ said, "It is My will that you make it to the resurrection. And it is the will of God the Father that you have everlasting life, and I will raise you up the last day." It's a fantastic promise. It's one we should never lose sight of. He repeats that over in John chapter 17 and verse 9. John chapter 17 and verse 9. Everything that's of real importance in the Bible is always given to us twice. God obeys His own principle that at the mouth of two witnesses a thing shall be established. We read this every year at Passover. It is Jesus Christ's last prayer to God the Father, except, of course, the ones we know of in the Garden of Gethsemane and perhaps the short ones on the crucifixion, stake, or cross. John 17 and verse 9, "I pray for them. I don't pray for the world, but for those whom you have given me, for they are yours. And all mine are yours, and yours are mine, and I am glorified in them. Now I am no longer in the world, but these are in the world. And I come to you, Holy Father, keep through your name those whom you have given me, that they may be one as we are one." So Jesus Christ prayed that God would keep us through His name. And notice how this promise that He gave earlier was fulfilled in the lives of the disciples. "While I was with them in the world, I kept them in your name, those whom you gave me." Remember, no one can come to Jesus Christ unless the Father draws him. It says in John 6 and verse 44, and the last part of that verse is, "And I will raise him up the last day." "While I was with them in the world, I kept them in your name." So, God, please continue to keep them in your name. "Those whom you gave me, I have kept, and none of them is lost, except the son of perdition, that the scripture might be fulfilled." So the prophecy, the promise He made earlier, came true in the lives of the disciples. None of them was lost, except Judas Iscariot, who very likely was never really of understanding to where he's going to be unable to repent. I believe that he'll have a chance to repent in the second resurrection, but that's just my understanding of what the scriptures say. But as far as the disciples who were called, who followed Jesus Christ, who heard His words, and especially heard those words that He would never leave us or forsake us, He says, "I have lost none." And that's His will for your life, that you would not be lost, but be in the first resurrection. And instead of leaving a physical Egypt, we are leaving a spiritual Egypt. Instead of following Moses, we're following Jesus Christ, the one who was in that pillar of fire and smoke. And during those days of unleavened bread, the lesson perhaps that we should spend some time thinking about and asking ourselves, have I really learned this yet, is have I learned to choose faith and not fear?